Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert. Happy to be with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you had an excellent 4th of July. I'm sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn, and it's Monday morning, time for all things political. So we'll be taking a look at the latest headlines in politics today, from immigration legislation to the oil spill. Whatever you want to talk about, we can discuss it this morning with our guest, Alexander Lamis, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. And we'd love to get you in on the conversation this morning. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Alec Lamis, so glad you could join us today.
Glad to be with you.
Well, how was your 4th of July?
Terrific. Good traditional 4th of July. Went to an amusement park.
Oh, well, that sounds pretty nice. Fireworks in the offering?
Fireworks both nights.
Nice. What do you think? I don't know if you were watching a lot of news yesterday. You were probably celebrating like a lot of people. Did any headlines catch your eye yesterday?
You got it right. I didn't watch any news yesterday, but you mentioned immigration reform. That's been a fascinating topic, I think, to watch over the last couple of weeks. I don't know what the insiders are planning, but it seems to me that it would be very smart for the Obama administration to push forward with immigration reform, even understanding that they may not get a bill. The reason I say that is, of course, this administration has had many legislative successes when you look back and try to do it in a dispassionate way on what's happened from the stimulus bill through health care reform and other changes. And this would be, one more legislative triumph leading into the midterm elections.
It sounds like nobody's got the stomach for it right now, though, except maybe President Obama, who's certainly mentioning it, but it's hard to tell if he even really feels like it's realistic.
Well, and Leader Reid seems to be very interested in it, too, in the Senate. And I think, sensible legislators, both parties recognize that this is a problem that really has to be addressed in a bipartisan way. A couple of years ago, they came very close to having a bipartisan agreement on all the outstanding issues. I mean, everyone understands that you have to control the borders, and then they also understand you have to do something about all the illegal aliens who are in the country. And so those go together, and then there are many other complicated, aspects about it, how you crack down on employers who hire illegals. And so forth. The reason I think they ought to charge forward now is after the election, which of course everyone is focused on now. There's no doubt that the Democrats will have diminished margins in both houses. We don't know what the margins will be, but it's pretty clear they'll be lower, and so the chances of Democratic leadership taking the country to immigration reform will be less.
And what about Hispanics? It's my understanding that the Obama administration is losing Hispanics right now, and that by at least talking about the willingness to push forward with immigration reform, that maybe they can stop that drain.
Well, yeah, that's right. It's sort of hard to be certain about which groups are losing support for the president, and that's because we're public doesn't focus clearly on on these questions when you're away from a presidential election, but we do take the polls and we do measure different changes and independents, for example, clearly support for the president among independents has declined somewhat in these polls, but what does that mean when we get to re-election time for the president? I'm not so sure. So that same thing about the Hispanics. I'm just not so sure that it's really declined.
Well, I guess. Well, I don't know. Will the midterm elections be the decisive evidence?
It was midterm elections.
Yeah,
no question. That it will be the most important political event between now and the next big election, the presidential election. And of course, there's a lot of speculation, much of it uninformed and kind of wild as to what the results are going to be. And you know, my view is you've got to get closer to the election, first of all. We, you know, candidates haven't been selected in a number of states yet, but we also don't know what the state of the economy will be then. We don't know what other, you know, what other major events will come up. Of course, this, no one would have predicted the oil spill in the Gulf, you know, several months ago, and we'll also know what the impact of that will be in November.
Hmm.
But as I said before, I mean, I think all political scientists would pretty much agree that the party in power faces a difficult time in the first election after presidential election, and this year's, you know, is that plus. But I'm not willing. I'm not one who's going to say, as I heard some commentators say, you know, many months ago, well, the Democrats have lost the House and the Senate. It's just too early to say anything like that.
Well, even by mentioning it, it's sort of like observing a particle in physics. You probably change what's going to happen by merely predicting like that.
If anyone pays attention to the
right.
predictions, I just don't know. You know, a lot of people just don't follow politics that closely. You know, not the listeners to your program, but the general public. You have to always keep that in mind. You know, just talk to your friends and your relatives on the 4th of July weekend about politics, and you find out how much there is a lack of interest in following these things closely.
Well, another story that's been top billing last night and this morning is Michael Steele, the RNC chair, being under fire for his comments on the war in Afghanistan.
Yes. Yeah, that's an amazing story coming after so many other gaffes by Chairman Steele. You know, just on the face of it, everyone understands that President Obama didn't start the war in Afghanistan. And so I don't know what the defense is of those comments or how that will play out.
They seem kind of bizarre, actually. I mean, you've got top Republican figures, John McCain, chastising him, some people calling for stepping down. So it seems like it's not going to play out too well for him.
That's the way it looks now, but, you know, there's been some other missteps, and I guess the party leaders have to consider, well, is it more detrimental to us to dump the party chair a few months before an election, or is it better just to wait this out, clarify the statement? I'm not sure how they handle it. But, you know, you did ask about the broad political arena, and, of course, Afghanistan is a major factor, I think, in the political equation today.
In terms of the film itself, I don't know if you've seen it on CNN or something, but it does look as though he's not really aware he's being filmed. The video is bad; it's from far away. It just makes you wonder what the scenario was and why he chose that moment to make those comments.
I haven't seen that. Not only we're in the fourth weekend, but we're just back from a trip south of several weeks, so I'm not fully caught up on everything, though I've been trying.
I think you'll have plenty of opportunity to see it today, if you're interested. Well, let's go to a phone call right now. We've got Jim joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to look at the thinking process that relates not only to Michael Steele, but the people that are criticizing him and the public at large. And I'll preface this by saying that, you know, it's okay for people to have fear about our security situation. But then the key issue is, you know, how do you deal with it and how do you think about it? And what are you going to do about it? So, for example, he said that and I'm citing today's Milwaukee Journal, it says that he said that Afghanistan was a war of Obama's choosing. Well, the original commitment of the war wasn't Obama's choosing, but the extension of the war and the upping the ante in terms of the number of troops there, that's basically true, and yet he's got a lot of criticism for that. Secondly, he said that this is not something that the United States has actively prosecuted or wanted to engage in. Well, again, this was initiated, this policy, this approach to the war was carried on during the Bush administration, and it did not only perpetuate the war, but it perpetuated the increase on the debt, which ostensibly everybody is concerned about. The 1,000 years land, or I mean, the fact that over 1,000 years nobody's been able to conquer Afghanistan. Apparently nobody wants to look at why that is, why nobody has been able to control Afghanistan, and what are we going to do about that. And finally, Steele said that there are other ways to engage in Afghanistan. Well, again, this is just one of these glittering generalities. What are these ways? Why has Obama implemented them? Has Bush implemented them? And if so, why haven't they worked? What else can we do? So you know, the whole approach to all of this in terms of the thinking of the public reminds me of a person who might be mentally challenged. It's not that they don't have the brain capacity like a retarded person might have, but they choose to be too lazy to look into the situation, and they also choose to be too deeply defended to actually examine whether there's any real basis that we can have to perpetuate this war and actually win this war.
All right, thank you, Jim. Alec Lamas?
Well, I think those are all very sensible observations, and one thing we ought to keep in mind, we don't have the papers, of course, yet of, you know, what the deliberations were in the Obama administration about Afghanistan, but I think it'd be wrong to conclude that President Obama made his choice without fully investigating all the options and the entire situation. And I say that because in thinking back to the Vietnam War involvement, you know, for the longest time, people thought, well, Lyndon Johnson just sort of stumbled into it. He inherited the troop involvement that Kennedy had left there, and he just plunged ahead not knowing what was going on. But the record shows something quite different, that he understood completely what the situation was. He realized the great risk to his presidency and to the country. But for other reasons, having to do with the state of the Cold War, having to do with his own political predicament. That is, he felt that the Cold Warriors of the old McCarthy era would get him, the Who Lost China crowd, put a lot of troops in Vietnam and kept it from falling. So I think we can be pretty certain that President Obama thought it through. Now, that doesn't mean that he made the right decision. In fact, within his administration, the reports are that there's, you know, very strong differences, Vice President Biden being the leader of a group not wanting such a heavy involvement. but that's my first reaction to those very interesting comments.
Well, and I gather this morning Steele has, as probably expected, stepped back from his original comments by emphasizing his support for the war. So we'll just have to see whether that's good enough, whether that flies.
Yeah, well, I don't think his position on a foreign policy issue like that is really not that significant to anybody, even most Republicans. But if what he was saying is that President Obama made the choice to put more troops in there and to adopt a new strategy, well, that is, you know, that is accurate. But the initial feeling you got was that somehow President Obama had picked this fight, and that's, you know, that everybody realizes that's not how it happened.
And there was the other part of the quote that was, at least on CNN, they were talking about it as the Princess Bride quote, where he talked about how Obama had stumbled into the famous gaffe of how you shouldn't get involved in a land war in, I guess, in the Princess Bride, it's Asia. And in this case, he substituted, Afghanistan. So it's interesting anyway, no matter how it plays out, I guess.
But the policy... underlying policy debate is very important. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are concerned about it and divided over it, because the notion that that we can go in and really transform a society that's quite different from our own and quite underdeveloped. It's not a phrase we like to use. I guess we want to find more politically correct ways, but it's just that they're at a very different level of development than we are, or the French, or the Dutch, and people. You know, we understand that, and we don't have good tools for transforming such a society. And why should we? There are 50, 100, 150 countries that are on that level of development, and we're not trying to transform them. The difference is, of course, Al-Qaeda had its that ought to be our focus, simply Al-Qaeda, not the transformation of Afghanistan. But I'm not, you know, that's just one person's view.
Well, and the transformation aside, the remarks do come at an interesting time with Petraeus taking over in Afghanistan and some criticism already from within Afghanistan about whether the 2011 withdrawal is remotely realistic.
Well, a lot of concern about that, you know, about that date, and it's been clarified by the administration, I think, is saying that, you know, we're not going to vanish from there on that date. It's just a date to begin a possible withdrawal of, you know, of a few troops. It's all pretty vague, it seems to me. But those who are opposed to the policy, and you have, you know, a lot of people in the left wing of the Democratic Party who are opposed to it, just think it is a sinkhole that we should not be in for the long term if it involves transformation of the Afghan society.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important debate, I think.
Well, let's head to break right now, take a short break, and come back, continuing our conversation this morning with Alec Lamas, the Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. And hopefully taking your phone calls this morning as well, whatever it is that's on your mind politically, we'd love to get you in on the conversation. You can join us this morning at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Monday morning. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn during this hour of All Things Political. We're joined this morning by Alec Lamas, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. Another phone call here. We have Hugh with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I'd like to talk about the nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court, particularly something that hasn't been stressed. Ms. Kagan, of course, had been a clerk for Thurgood Marshall. Marshall, of course, supported affirmative action. And I have little doubt that Elena Kagan would have voted in 2003 in favor of the Michigan affirmative action case, whereby there were white women who sued. They had better qualifications than some of the minorities, and yet they were denied admission to the university. Because Kagan really, in the end, feels that you should judge people by the color of the skin or the box which they hit on the affirmative action brochure. And she will deny promotions and admission of people because of their race. And now look at the Supreme Court. Jews are about 2 or 3% of the American people, already have 22% of the Supreme Court. Protestants, who are a majority of Americans, if Kagan is nominated, will have 0%, no representatives on the highest court in the land. If she is nominated, one-third of the Supreme Court will be Jewish. Now, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibited discrimination, not only on race, but on religion. If she's nominated, in effect, it will be discrimination against the majority of Americans, the Protestants of America. She should be rejected no matter what her qualifications are. There are her group, her race is already 22%, way out of proportion, and Protestants are way discriminated against. And it shows...
Okay, thanks, Hugh. Let's get our guest in on this, Alec Lamas.
Yes, be glad to comment. You know, first on the Michigan affirmative action cases, you know, there were two cases, and I think, I'm not sure that Hugh said it this way, but I think Elena Kagan would have supported the majority view that came out of those cases, which essentially affirmed the Bakke decision of some decades before, that said affirmative action can be used in certain circumstances as long as there aren't rigid quotas involved, and that's been in essence compromise that we've settled on in American constitutional law on that point. But on the broader question of representation by religions on the Supreme Court, what's fascinating to me is that there are so many Catholics on the court, and that this has drawn little comment until just recently, and not much at that. I don't think most people realize that the two-thirds that Hugh was mentioning are Catholics, and the one-third that would be Jews, and the third would be Elena Kagan. I think it's, frankly, a recognition that we're not interested in these religious backgrounds issues anymore in this country. If we go back to when the first Jew was appointed to the court, I think that was Justice Brandeis, but I could be wrong. There was a big to-do about it, and he suffered anti-Semitic comments, as well as even the displeasure of another member of the justice, who made it clear he had wanted nothing to do with Brandeis because he was Jewish. that's, you know. Oh, and as for the no Protestants being on the court today, that's exactly right, and that would be the case, and I think she is going to be confirmed. But if you look back over American history and you started tabulating the times that were all Protestants on the court, you see that the Protestants have had a pretty good run on the court. But I think the most important part is what I said earlier, that we're just not that interested in religious background, I think.
All right, next call here. We have Donnie joining us from Montello. Hi, Donnie.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I would just like to get his opinion on the fact that Obama, what he campaigned on as far as being so opposite of Bush, promising to get the terrorists out of Camp X-Ray and move to the States, promising to get rid of the Patriot Act, and yet we're still spying on Americans, and so many things that he looked down on President Bush on, but hasn't done much to change it.
Well, that's I think correct in the sense that there are some foreign policy areas where President Obama has not abruptly changed policy, and but you know, by the time of the election, President Bush had moved in the direction of President Obama's position. I think probably the best case of that is in Iraq, as you know, the run up to the 2008 election occurred. President Bush's administration was changing its policy to pretty much come to a consensus view that there'd be troop withdrawals at a certain point, and Iraqis would take over, and President Obama's continued that. As for the Patriot Act, I don't think President Obama, as a candidate, ever said he was going to scrap the Patriot Act. He said he was going to modify it in some ways, and I'm not sure the details how that is proceeding. But he has certainly expressed interest in not violating civil liberties of Americans, if at all possible. But of course, he has a responsibility of protecting the country. So I probably would have to go back and very carefully look at his remarks and then compare them with the details of what he's doing to be certain. But all of your comments, I think, were in the national security domain. I think on domestic affairs, there's a very abrupt change based on the campaign promises.
Well, Donnie is voicing what has been a pretty common refrain among a lot of Democrats, though, that Obama may not be as partisan as we may like. He might not be as Democratic, stepping up for Democrats, being vocal and attacking Republicans.
Are you asking me? Or,
yes.
Oh,
yes,
I didn't know if I called or stole a line.
No.
That's an interesting topic. The depth of partisanship of President Obama. Of course, he made his national debut in 2004 Democratic Convention with that landmark speech talking about blue America and red America, and how the Republicans have divided the country, and how he he's a partisan Democrat, and I think he's acted that way in domestic affairs, even though he's made many overtures to Republicans, and they've been spurned in most cases. So I think some of the lack of reaching across the partisan divide is not to be put on Obama's court, but rather to be seen as part of the strategy of the Republicans to simply obstruct the president and hope to win the next elections.
Well, thank you to Donnie for your phone call. Let's take another call now. We've got Mike joining us from Columbia County. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
When I heard longtime caller Hugh call in, I just had to call and voice my disagreement with his remarks. I guess if we are to live in a colorblind and completely society which doesn't look at those type of qualifications, then I guess it's just a little bit off the wall for him to complain, or for anyone to complain, that we don't have any Protestant participation on the court, and that we would have too many Jews on the court or anything like that. That's about all I wanted to say, except it was good to hear his voice after a number of years. And he's always, it's also one other thing I wanted to say is it's sad that it was so easy for me to call in on the show at half past the hour. I mean, doesn't anybody else besides myself and Hugh and a few other callers care about this topic? I mean, if we were some of the other topics that you can't call in, even if you had a direct hotline, and it seems like those really don't forward the quality of life and the political discussion in the United States, and this topic that does, I mean, is everybody sleeping in this morning?
Well, it is the post-fireworks day, so...
Yeah, Veronica, thanks, for everything you do and for bringing these important topics, and I wish I could just reach out and, shake people up and say, hey, listen to this. This is much more important than, gardening is important and, whatever people listen to, but, there's no rattling, like some of the AM...
There's a place for all of it,
but we
appreciate your point, Mike.
I think the callers that are listening understand that. I'm sorry, and thanks to the guest and everything. This is the kind of discussion people should listen to.
I was going to say, those of us in political science certainly support that view. We're very much in favor of political discussion, and when you look at America today compared to where we were 30, 40 years ago, frankly, I think it's great that we have the three cable networks devoted to a lot of political chatter. You can complain about the nature of some of that discourse. We have C-SPAN, which brings us events, political events from the Capitol all through the country. I mean, it is, and then we can go on and on. I think we have a wonderful opportunities for people to follow politics, and I agree with that, Mike. More people should, because it's very important.
Well, thank you for your call, Mike, and thanks for your compliments on the hour. And we're glad that you're listening in and enjoying. And just to switch topics here for a moment, of course, this has been the top story for weeks and weeks. It says something, I guess, that it wasn't today, but the oil spill and the appearance of the skimmer A-Whale, which we have high hopes for. Have you been following that, Alec?
Yes, I have. All Americans, I'm just shocked at how this developed and the tragedy for the people who are there. I'm originally from Charleston, South Carolina, and the oil's probably unlikely to work its way around that way. But I have a lot of friends and relatives who go to the beaches that are being affected, and of course the livelihoods of all those fishermen and others. But I really don't know any more other than that.
Well, I heard this morning that a third of Gulf waters are closed to fishermen, which is an enormous chunk of income down the drain for half the a third of the waters being closed. And the bigger political question to tie this in, of course, is how this is going to affect Democrats, the Obama administration, particularly at midterm time.
Well, that's right, and you know we don't know that, of course. But if the relief wells kick into place as planned in August, and presumably the flow of the oil will pretty much come to a stop fairly quickly, and then it's all cleanup, and we've got the compensation package in place now, and that's an achievement, I think, for the Obama administration and for BP as well, that they're owning up to at least on the surface they appear to be owning up to their responsibility, but you'll have to see. It's just, I'm sure, you know, if you ask, you know, President Obama, I mean, I think a candid response was that he doesn't care what his political, you know, the political side of it. He wants to help those people, and I think President Bush would have said the same thing. Any American would say that.
There's, I guess this isn't politics, but it is interesting to note that BP at this moment is worried about a takeover of the company.
I hadn't heard that.
Right, they're taking steps to shore up the company to prevent, I guess,
a takeout. Yeah, that's a terrible, you know, corporate position for them to be in, I'm sure. But I don't know much about the international corporate world.
Well, let's take a second break right now, and we'll get some more callers in on our conversation this morning. It's All Things Political this morning, and we're talking about it all. We've talked immigration legislation, the possibility of that. We've been talking about the oil spill, talking about Elena Kagan, and the Afghanistan situation with Michael Steele is the other topic. We'll be happy to talk about all of that or whatever is on your political mind this morning. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email if you'd rather. You can send it to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, Veronica Rickert, back with you during All Things Political. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn as we talk with Alec Lamus, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. Taking another phone call here, we have Jim joining us from Galena, Illinois. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
About the corporation situation and the oil spill, and I've been pretty effective and active in politics and retired now. I'm 70, in my 70s. But as long as this country and the politicians have a policy of restrictions on individual and let the corporations do as they want to, no mandatory requirements. In Norway, it's mandatory when you go on deep water wells that they have a second well. They got to drill two, and the second one has to be in place before they start pumping oil, so things like this can't happen. But in this country, in America, it seems, and the political parties of both conservative, I'm basically a progressive, but the conservative movement doesn't want any restrictions at all on corporations, and that's why you have this type of oil spill. Now they're all wondering why it happened. Well, it happened because there's no controls. It happened because it wasn't mandatory to do certain things to make it safe. It happened because of greed, and it's just sickening. That Gulf down there will be affected for the next 50 years. It's going to just ruin it.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Jim. And one of the questions therein, Alec, is whether we might see some legislation about corporate responsibility come out of this.
Well, I think we will. There's no question that it will be heavily investigated. But I got to congratulate Jim on, in a very brief period of time, he added a bit of information that, frankly, I had not heard, and I think is very important, that the requirement that in Norway that a second well be drilled when you drill the first well. I had not heard that.
I think that is a
very sensible policy. You know, to broaden that observation, let me say, you know, we can learn a lot from other countries in the way they do some things. And, you know, I don't know if you've had on your program T.R. Reid, who's written this excellent book, The Healing of America. on health care. He dedicates the book to Dwight Eisenhower because, he says, Eisenhower found a European model for our interstate highway system, the German Autobahn. And he dedicates that book on health care, which explores how other countries deal with health care, a very detailed and illuminating study, to Eisenhower, because he's saying we should do the same thing. And the first thing you learn from those comparative investigations is that none of the advanced countries in the world allow for-profit health insurance companies. They're all non-profit in where the private sector dominates. Anyway, just got off on a tangent there, but it's the same, the same point. We could learn. We certainly could have learned from Norway, and I would like to see an investigation into whether that was ever proposed and why it was killed and so forth. And I think people who were affected in the Gulf would be outraged to hear that there was a procedure that could have been used as a backup in addition to all those other fail-safe measures.
Well, apparently NPR has been on top of that and has reported that it does cost $120 million to drill that second well. So obviously companies are not going to be eager to do that. Of course, if it's regulation, if it's law, they're going to have to do it.
Well, yes, and when you see what can happen if all the other fail-safe measures fail, I think you would get the same reaction that you and I had when we heard that information for the first time. That's something. Really, a second well. I never thought about that. That should be a requirement.
Well, thanks so much to Jim for that call, and we move on to Mike from Whitefish Bay. Hello, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
This last Friday's Wall Street Journal, there was a major article describing the Cuban government and its recent willingness to grant offshore drilling leases to companies that have applied for the last 25 years. The major one is Repco, which is the Spanish oil company giant. And I think it's sort of politically curious that at the time that we still have these antithetical relations with the Cuban government, that they picked this time to grant all these leases for drilling 60 miles away from the tip of Florida.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that call. Alec Lamas?
No, that's fascinating. I didn't know that either. You have quite a group of listeners who are extremely well-informed and raise interesting questions. Of course, that takes us into the international domain and who controls, the seas. And then the more recent issue would be what kind of environmental protections are there in international waters or in waters that abut other countries? And what should be required? But other than that, I don't, I would be suspicious, too, of the motivations. After all, the Cubans are hostile to us as we've been hostile to them, the Cuban government, that is.
Well, thanks so much for bringing that up, Mike. We appreciate it. And another call here from Jordan with us from Madison. Hello, Jordan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to go back to something that your guest had said before the break, talking about the media and how lucky we are or how good it is that we have, all the cable networks and... I assumed, access to print and radio journalism was up there when he was talking about, those being good things for our political discourse. I disagree. I think that those things are good on paper, and the idea that we have, networks dedicated to just the news or just the politics, I think those can be very, very helpful ideas on paper. But the way it plays out with these networks trying to get ratings, I think it makes the political discourse very derisive, and I think that the media coverage of politics, more than anything, turns Washington and every state capital into this win-by-the-day sort of culture, where now we have, we used to call the media the fourth branch of the government, and now we have like a fifth branch of comedians and people who make jokes that check our media the way our media should check our government. I wonder if your guest has any comments on the downside of all that political coverage, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Ken.
I I certainly don't disagree with any of that. My point is that I just like to see people engaged in political conversation, even when it's stupid conversation, you might say, or when it's highly partisan and so forth. But if that is drawing in, whether it's Fox News or MSNBC on the other side of the spectrum, if that's just drawing in hundreds of thousands of people to thinking about a political issue, even if they may be misled briefly and one way or the other, or if it increases partisan antagonism, that doesn't bother me. What bothers me is apathy and lack of knowledge. I think people always have to search out the truth. And they find it frequently in their own personal circumstances. If the talk is one way, and they're seeing a reality in their lives and with their friends, people aren't going to be swayed. The big political question that we haven't touched on today, of course, is the state of the economy, and that's something that people feel every day. And there's no amount of puff talk from the White House or from opposition in Congress that can change, that reality. And that reality, just to, add to those earlier discussions of the elections, will be very important in November.
In terms of what Ken was referencing, the divisiveness of politics in America, maybe in thanks to the different networks and the partisanship of what you see in the media, do you see a better model of engagement? I mean, what do you think about the blogosphere and sort of people taking journalism into their own hands?
Well, I don't mind that either, frankly. I mean, I'm heavily in tune to the digital world and all of that, but I don't follow the blogosphere closely. But I use the internet to follow, you might say, mainstream internet sources, the kinds of things that you have at your fingertips that you didn't have before, like what the Washington Post is saying and the others. But I think it's one offshoot of all this, of course, is something we'll have to confront, is the whole question of hurting people's reputation by lying and defaming people and that sort of thing. And I think we've got to confront that at some point, and the blogosphere is it could be a real problem. Maybe a real problem today in that regard. I don't know. But in terms of just basic increase in partisanship, I have to say that doesn't bother me. One reason I think we have a stronger divide today between the Republicans and the Democrats is we have two more cohesive parties that are opposing each other. And many people who haven't followed, the history of our political parties don't realize that one of the big reasons for that is the destruction of the old one-party Democratic South. Nothing to do, really, with partisanship Republican-Democrat as the country has experienced it for many decades. That was all about white people keeping blacks in a second-class status, and they were using the Democratic Party as that vehicle. With the Civil Rights Revolution, that was destroyed, and we began to get a two-party system, and we have a vigorous two-party system today throughout the country, but especially in the South, and that has contributed to the impression that the parties are more partisan simply because the Democratic Party has become more a unified party, and it wasn't in the old days.
Well, it is interesting, and if you go back even farther than that, didn't the party swap the political positions? Republicans generally supported what Democrats did and vice versa. The very beginning of our political system.
Well, I think that's right. And one of the things I teach is American political party history and development, as well as, believe it or not, your guests may not believe it, but news media and politics. But I think that your point is is well taken. The Democratic Party of Andrew Jackson was a states' rights party, very very much skeptical of the power of the national government. But the Democratic Party coming out of the Depression era, the party of Franklin Roosevelt, became a party enamored with the use of the federal government in a whole host of social and economic arenas. And the Republicans opposed that. And the Republicans were the inheritors of the Whig tradition coming before the Civil War and the Republican tradition after the Civil War that to have a national banking system, those kinds of things. So that switch is fascinating, and the way to see it is just as you said, is to see it in the historical context.
And as long as you brought it up, Professor Lamas, we should be talking about a little economy here before we get to the end of the hour. The numbers haven't been great. They haven't been decisive either. And everyone is wondering at this moment whether we're seeing a pause in the recovery or whether this is a double-dip recession.
That's right. And I've listened, that's one thing I haven't caught in the last few days, actually, is some good discussion by economists of where we're headed. And they don't know. That's the bottom line. They're conflicting opinions. And I don't either, but it's certainly something that will have an important impact on the way the average voter evaluates the parties in November. And if the economy continues to go along at the same listless rate or even declines, obviously that will hurt President Obama and the Democratic Party. But if he can make a good case that he has initiatives in place to really transform this environment that we find ourselves in, this economic environment, then he could make this a good issue for him down the road. I haven't seen that much focus apart from the important stimulus bill.
Let's go back to the phones as we get toward the end of the hour here. A call from Ken in Ashwaubenon. Hi, Ken.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My first call. Thanks for taking it. Appreciate this program. I understand you said something about immigration earlier. I didn't hear it. I apologize. But that's my issue, and I'll try and make this very quick. First, I think we've got to stop illegal immigration across our southern border. We've got to stop it. I'm not opposed to a worker program, people coming here for 3 years and working and sending money home. That's terrific, but it's got to be controlled. Secondly, it seems to me that the 14th Amendment has to be changed in the sense that if a person, a child is born in this country of illegal immigrants, that person is automatically a citizen. I think that's got to be changed, because once that happens, you can't send the parents home. They're going to stay here with their child. So I think that definitely is a change that has to occur. And thirdly, what's troubling to me is there's talk about amnesty for 12 to 15 million illegal immigrants. And they're basically, let's face it, they're basically from Mexico, Hispanics. If that happens, our politicians already are catering to that vote. And if we get 12 to 15 million more voters, our culture is going to change. And whether you like it or not, we're basically a Western European and African American culture in this country. And I'd like to keep it that way and not have it go Hispanic. So that gives me a great deal of difficulty. And I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Well, I think that's already, no matter what we do, that's already a goodbye. The culture is not going to be Western European and African American. And we've already seen the figures from that, right, Alec Lamas?
Well, yeah, that's right. And no doubt about it. And, Texas is a good example. California, as well. The demographers are predicting a major impact of Hispanics in those two states in the next few decades. But for your caller, what we said at the beginning of the program is, at least what I said, was that I'd like to see President Obama push forward in an effort to come to a bipartisan solution to the immigration problem. And you're exactly right to say that there are many aspects to it that need to be addressed. Personally, I wouldn't change the 14th Amendment on that issue of people being born in this country. I think that not every country does it that way. Some countries do deny citizenship to people born on their land, some Western European countries. But I like the idea of people born in America being Americans, regardless of how their parents got here. But that could be debated along with all the other aspects of it, and then maybe we could come to something that would be pretty close to a national settlement for this issue. If there's strong border security, strong effort in the area of employment, and then we do something sensible about the people who are in our midst now who are not citizens. But I'm not an expert on immigration policy, and I'm sure that that might seem naive to someone who is.
Well, Alec Lamas, we've only got about 20, 30 seconds for your answer, but what are you looking forward to in politics this week?
Well, I kind of take a slightly longer view. I'm looking forward to the midterm elections and seeing how they come out, but also learning more about how the election is playing out in other parts of the country. And we'll be having primaries coming up. I don't have the dates right in front of me, but I'm all those things electoral. I'm looking forward to.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning. And, yeah, we look forward to those midterms, too. You'll probably be back on talking with us again.
I'd enjoy it. But thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you. Alexander Lamas, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Cheryl Gasser for production this morning. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.